refuse to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear part one of a two-parter with top-ranking NSA whistleblowers William Binney and Thomas Drake. These men have been retaliated against because they exposed corruption, ineffective management, and all kinds of hijinks inside the NSA. And now, they fight for our constitutional right to be free of intrusive and unconstitutional surveillance. And in particular, Tom Drake offers a powerful refutation of the talking point that's an official talking point from the NSA PR department that is being repeated by President Obama, by Senator Feinstein, and many other political leaders. And that is that 9/11 could have been prevented if the massive collection of our telephone data had been underway before that fateful day. Tom Drake says that's not only false and cynical, but that NSA had actionable intelligence that could have busted up the 9/11 plot. They didn't use it. They, in some cases, didn't know they had it, and they didn't share it with other agencies. It's all ahead in part two, where Binney and Drake present their 21-point agenda for real reform of the intelligence community. We'll release that in a day or so. And before we get to the podcast, I want to thank Robert Rutledge, David Paulson, and Deborah Newell. They have just signed up for another one-year subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I am very grateful. I need your support, too. Will you join them? Come to my website, peterbcollins.com. This particular podcast we're issuing without any subscription required because we want people to hear it and hear it right away. But come on over and sign up, and if you take our best deal, the $50 annual subscription, we'll get you a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee on its way from the Big Island of Hawaii right now, and a bonus book from the Progressive Book Collection here in the Peter B. Collins shop. The other way you can support us, whether you're a subscriber or not, is to take the deal from audible.com. Follow the link in this show podcast show file or the banner ad on the left-hand side at peterbcollins.com. And if you take a 30-day trial subscription at audible.com, they'll reward you with a free audiobook download from their 150,000 title collection. And they'll pay me $15 because you've tried Audible. And if you don't like it, you can cancel before 30 days, and it won't cost you a penny. Responding to calls from many quarters to reform what's been called a rogue agency, the National Security Agency, the Obama administration has been holding high-level meetings at the White House with various stakeholders, including critics like Senator Ron Wyden and others who have been critical of the agency and who have leveled important charges about wrongdoing and abuse of the privileges granted by the government. And later this week, on January 17th, the president is scheduled to articulate his ideas for reform. But there are people in the know who would like to meet with President Obama directly. People who worked at the NSA, who know what has gone wrong and how to fix it. And two of the four individuals who wrote an open memo to the president and followed it up with a 21-point plan for real reform of our intelligence communities join me today, and they've appeared on our program before. Bill Binney was one of the highest-ranking technical officers at the NSA. He started there in 1970, and he left in protest in the fall of 2001 when he picked up what was going on there. Bill Binney, thanks for joining me again on the Peter B. Collins Show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Thomas Drake, likewise, has served our nation for many years. He served in the Air Force and in the Navy and went to work for the NSA after working as a contractor to the agency. His first day of formal employment there, remarkably, was September 11th of 2001. Tom, thanks for returning to our program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
And I want to tell you both that listener response to the interviews that we have done previously has been very strong and very favorable. And at the outset, I just have to thank you both for the courage that you've shown in confronting these issues and in working to restore our Fourth Amendment rights and other elements of the Bill of Rights.
Well, thank you, too. Thank you for saying that, yeah.
All right. And Tom Drake, you've paid quite a price because you were brought up on charges, including heavy-duty charges under the Espionage Act. And it's, of course, both of you have faced retaliation for speaking the truth. And again, we're very grateful for those sacrifices that you've made. I want to start with the 18-page memo that was published at consortiumnews.com. Our friend and colleague Robert Perry is the editor and publisher there. And you had some help in drafting this from the veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. My friend Ray McGovern, Colleen Rowley, the FBI whistleblower from Minneapolis, Dan Ellsberg, and Elizabeth Murray are co-signers of the open memo that you wrote. Bill, let me turn to you first, because in the memo, you speak directly to the President of the United States, and you offer to meet with him to share the significant amount of knowledge that you have about what's gone on, what's gone wrong, some elements of fraud, and fundamentally failures in the main mission of the NSA. Tell us a little bit about the history of these memos to the president and why you decided that this was the right time to write this one.
I think we all pretty much decided that now was a pretty good time, certainly because we were starting to get a reaction in the country. Not just in Congress. Congress is starting to react after the Amash Conyers effort to defund NSA. That kind of said there was a movement inside the country to try to do something. And then the president, appointed this commission that looked at it and made some suggestions. And we went over them and we said really didn't do enough. You know, it really didn't. It got cosmetic things done. It really didn't come get to the point address issues that would make some meaningful difference in NSA. So we thought we'd draft our own together and try to compile it and send it to him, because we thought this was the right time to do that, because we felt that he was getting a prejudiced issue or a prejudiced perspective on the issues at NSA.
And your memo presumes that the president knows most things, but you allow for the idea that he may not know everything, that he may have been misled on certain issues. But you also write, "Mr. President, we've given up hope that your palace guard will let us in. So our chances of reaching you seem far better via this memorandum, the 28th of its kind issued since early 2003. So tell me, has there been any reaction, official, unofficial, back channel? Has someone at the White House read this memo, Bill?
Yes, we know that was in the hands of the White House counsel.
Mm-hmm.
So we know it made it that far.
All right.
So we wanted to publish it so that it'd be out in the open and everybody could see it, that there were differences, that there were ways of really solving these problems without violating privacy or violating the Constitution or any of the laws we had prior to some of the amendments that tried to change them. So we thought that was the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
so that it couldn't, A, be buried by bureaucrats, either in the White House, in Congress, or anywhere else, and that it would make it could make the light of day for everyone to see.
And you speak to your own motivation. You ask, why do we still care? And you answer, because we have consciences. Because the oath we took has no expiration date. Because we know, as few others do, how critically important it is for our country to have a well-functioning, Constitution-abiding national security agency. And because we know how that ship can be steered back on course at that important place of work by improving its ability to find terrorists and other criminals in massive amounts of data while protecting the right to privacy and citizen sovereignty. And Tom Drake, if you could characterize your own feelings toward the NSA, what I pick up from this memo is that you and your colleagues are deep believers in the original mission of the NSA and its first commandment, and you want to try to get it back on track. You do not seek to destroy the agency.
No, but they're certainly off track, and some, I would actually say they've come off the, you know, the constitutional rails. It's important to understand that NSA was actually created in the deepest of secrecy during the early years of the Cold War in 1952, in fact, although there were predecessor organizations. And it was always about foreign intelligence. But also, there was a dark side, and the dark side included Operation Shamrock, which, starting in World War II and then all the way up through the mid-70s, with the telex companies, and there were several of them, not just Western Union, but ITT, for example, as well as RCA Global, were actually pulling telexes indiscriminately, going in and out of and through the country on a mass scale. I mean, that's just an early indicator, as well as other programs in which the vast power of NSA, even then with this technology, was being used for other purposes besides foreign intelligence. We have to be remindful of that, because all this came to a head in the 1970s. And this is an era in which I was a very young teenager growing up and was eyewitness and, you know, listening to, you know, Richard Milhouse Nixon, as President of the United States, actually resign his office. We have to remember that articles of impeachment had actually been formulated by the House of Representatives, and that included the abuse of the National Institutes of Power, and using FBI's COINTEL Pro, for example, as well as other operations, like Operation Minaret, against Americans unlawfully and unconstitutionally. And so, you know, that power must be constrained. And I absolutely shuddered as I became eyewitness, never imagining. I just never actually imagined. There were all the abuses of the 50s, 60s, and 70s culminating under the Nixon administration, you know, that 3 decades later that I would be faced with the distinct prospect of seeing my own country, my own government, actually, in the deepest of secrecy, unchaining itself from the very Constitution that it was sworn to uphold, and, in fact, was now considering the Constitution in the way of a national security state.
And, Tom, what you're describing in the history there will give away the fact that I'm a little older than you. I was a young talk show host in Chicago at the time of the Watergate scandal, and I covered it in great depth. And it was really a life lesson for me in understanding how far off the constitutional rails our government could get. And I covered the COINTELPRO issues and the murder of Black Panther Fred Hampton by the Chicago police under an FBI sting program. And so I have, you know, deep history with that. And I'm really glad you brought it up, because I'm one of those people who looked at the Church Commission, the Pike Commission, the efforts to reform the abuses that had clearly occurred under Nixon. And I thought, wow, I can be proud of my country again. We've fixed that. We've you know, retuned to honor the Constitution and to end the use of assassination, for example, of foreign leaders. Those were some of the commitments that we made during the reform era of the 1970s. And so it is as shocking and painful for me to see how we didn't learn from those lessons, and in the panic after 9/11, and I'm being generous to attribute it only to panic, our government officials decided that the Constitution was secondary to a mania to respond to the events of 9/11. And it's time that we, you know, study and learn those lessons again, because I really think that we are destroying the bedrock guarantees in the Constitution, which is the contract we have with our government.
You know, it's one of the great ironies of our own country. For all the faults and contradictions, and there are many, including those of the so-called founding fathers, which, you know, largely born in myth and legend, they needed to protect their own rights. I mean, they were the elite of the day, but they were resisting the crown. And in order to protect their rights, they had to extend their rights to everybody else. And that really, really was, to me, the critical foundation, the critical driver for the first 10 amendments. Remember, the original Constitution, as it was ratified by the states, did not have the first 10 amendments, because there was concern that it was, even though it was born out of, you know, the extraordinary Declaration of Independence, we had fought an American Revolution, we're now free as a new nation, we had the failure of the Articles of Confederation. They were very, very, very fresh in their minds, and so they had to meet in the deep secrecy to form a new government. And that new, out of that extraordinary summer in Philadelphia, that long, hot summer, was born the Constitution. But those first 10 amendments are so fundamental to the grand experiment in preserving and protecting, defending what is so essential with respect to that grand experiment. It was clear to me after 9/11 that the illusion that we were a constitutional government, okay, that we actually were different, that somehow that the grand experiment was worth protecting, preserving, defending, that all just disappeared before my very eyes. And national security, which I would argue was actually created in 1947 as the foundation for all this, ironically enough, in response to the beginnings of World War II in terms of our entree, and there's a lot of history there, of course, we would never again be surprised. We would never again have an electronic Pearl Harbor. Even though there's other history regarding the Pearl Harbor, that was the reason why, in large part, this thing was put into place. That ultimately led to a military-industrial complex warned against, you know, was warned against in this nation by the farewell address of President Eisenhower in 1961. Most people just dismiss that, even some of the language he used, complex, Hall, what's this, what does it mean, not fully comprehending. He had presided over the foundation of that, mm-hmm. you know, 8 years as president, realizing what this might mean going forward. Of course, then we saw what happened in the 70s. Even Frank Church himself warned the nation in 1975 what would happen if, with the advances in technology, what would happen if, and I'm paraphrasing him, that kind of power in later years would be turned against the United States. And as Bill himself has said in other interviews and on panel sessions, I have said in different language, the equivalent of turnkey tyranny would be created, and would be able to pull ourselves back out of the abyss. I was faced, here I am, night just after 2001, faced, looking, staring into the abyss, realizing in the deepest of secrecy we're now unchained, and it was going to have enormous strategic consequences downstream for this nation and for the world, that what we would unleash in terms of opening up the Pandora's box would have far more consequences, both intended and unintended, than people fully appreciate or realize at that time. And I made a vow that I was going to fight from within as long as I could until I could no longer do so.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Binney, with your history going back to 1970, you were there when the reforms took place, when they were implemented following the Church Commission and presidential directives, congressional action. And you saw the agency through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then you saw it take a very different path in the fall of 2001. Describe your own sense of this roller coaster ride and what prompted you to resign in protest.
Well, I think it was fundamentally the trade-off of values of what it meant to be an American. I mean,
if you looked at it in a larger sense, in the 20th century, we, along with other democracies, were prepared to sacrifice the lives of millions of people to sustain our ability to be free and have our liberties as laid out in the first 10 amendments of the Constitution. I mean, we were prepared to, and literally many of us have lost over millions of men in wars to defend those things. And yet, after 9/11, we were prepared to throw them away for the sake of a few thousand terrorists and not stand up to the values we had in the past, which was to do anything to maintain our freedoms. That was paramount.
Now,
I
Bill,
mean, the fact that external threats existed didn't stop us from defending our rights, no matter what the cost.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
We've lost those values.
And Bill, I just want to note that you were one of the highest-ranking technical officials at the NSA, and you helped develop the response to the whole explosion of digital technology, the Internet, and fiber optics instead of a satellite-based communications. And you were, you know, right at the top of the NSA machinery there as it was responding to the changes in technology. But from my conversations with you and the interviews I've read that you've done with others, you're very clear that you never supported any expansion of the role of the NSA that would conflict with our Fourth Amendment and other Bill of Rights guarantees.
Yes, that's exactly right. In fact, I made it perfectly clear. And in fact, that's why I thought if I did it right, you know, right in the first place, that they would see the light and realize that that's the proper way to do it, the constitutionally acceptable way, something that was legal and acceptable to the public. Even if it was discussed openly, it would be acceptable. And that was to protect identities as a part of the process, as well as not take in, once you recognize what you had, not take it in to begin with. That is, keep all of the data that the other 300 million Americans were using out of our databases. Unlike today, they simply opted to take all that data in, which is the bulk input of information. That's why they're becoming dysfunctional. They're taking in too much data instead of being able to sort it out right up front, which was the other approach that we took. Be able to recognize what's important to select out of this massive flow of information and look at and pull only that out so that makes the data and analysis of the data a manageable problem.
And so with this, what you've just described, why is it that the NSA is fighting so hard to maintain the bulk collection of metadata? And we'll get to the fact that they can't give us a single example of where it has been useful in a terrorism case. But fundamentally...
Well, because they're using it for law enforcement.
Go ahead, explain that a little more, Bill.
Well, what they're doing is the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Agency and other... federal agencies, law enforcement, have access to that data. And that's how they build cases against individuals and use that data to go arrest people.
Mm-hmm.
Once they do that, though, they see they can't use the NSA data in court. So that was acquired without a warrant, so it's not admissible in a court. So therefore, they have to do a parallel construction, which means they have to go through and find data that would implicate them in the crime prior to arresting them, and then substitute that for the NSA data, and then use that in the courts. So as I keep saying on different programs here, I refer to this as a planned programmed perjury policy run right out of the Department of Justice, where they're lying to the courts, they're lying to the judges, the prosecuting and defending attorneys, and submitting false evidence, that is, perjured evidence, in as the reason for arrest in the beginning. But they do use it to do plea bargains.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the benefits, I guess, for it. They can get most of them in a plea bargain as opposed to having to go to court. But when they go to court, they have to do this parallel construction.
Now, Tom Drake, you were there during the effort following 9/11 to sort out whether we could have prevented 9/11 with information that had already been collected by the NSA. And in previous podcasts, I don't want to repeat too much of it, but our listeners have heard Bill Binney describe the internal struggle over Thin Thread and Trailblazer. And we now have General Michael Hayden, who ran the NSA and later became the Director of National Intelligence, trotted out to the media on a regular basis as a defender of the NSA. And one of the things that he keeps saying is a quote from this handpicked commission that the president had write a report, and we're going to talk about some of their recommendations. But one of the claims they've made is that no abuses have occurred. And that is flatly false on the face of it, because we've seen widespread abuse of the rights of innocent Americans whose data have been collected. But talk a little bit about General Hayden, his role at the NSA during the critical months after 9/11, and the whether or not his claims can be believed today.
Well, he's the master of the big lie, Peter. I mean, it's important to know that. And he's extraordinarily culpable. He's a central figure in everything that happened after 9/11. He's part of the, you know, the extraordinary compact that was arrived at between himself and the White House, and in particular Dick Cheney and David Addington. You know, what other authorities can I use? Well, the authorities that he had, you know, under the Constitution and FISA, did not permit him to do bulk copy, collection of anything. And, you know, there was the restriction, though they had hot pursuit. He chose to just completely and flagrantly, willfully, and deliberately violate his own oath to support and defend the Constitution, and do so in the deepest of secrecy. And so, Hayden has to defend what he felt was a higher purpose. And his higher purpose was that it was his mark on history, and he would be the executive agent. And in fact, literally, NSA was selected, was defined as the executive agent, made the executive agent for the secret mass surveillance program, a surveillance program now that's fully metastasized, extraordinarily institutionalized. It's become normalized after all, you know, these 12 plus years since 9/11, and it's the world, the likes the world has never seen. I mean, a former Stasi officer, and it's important. Why do I personally, even publicly, continue to emphasize this? History is simply not kind at all. I was a German-Russian cryptolinguist during the Cold War. I flew an RC-135 against the Warsaw Pact for a number of years, and did electronic warfare missions later. And what was the country in which I became an expert? The target country was East Germany, a fascist surveillance state. I never imagined that the template for surveillance would be used as the basis and the foundation for our surveillance apparatus put into place in the United States and, of course, now around the world. It's important to note that a former Stasi officer, this was shortly after the Snowden disclosures began in June of last year, said it's the height, I'm paraphrasing him, the height of naivete to believe that when a government agency has this much access to this much data, that they're not going to use it for other purposes. Well, that's clearly demonstrated in our own history during the 1970s. And they had nowhere near the technology that they have today. They actually had to work at it a bit just to get it back then. Here, my gosh, I mean, they've got all these extraordinary agreements and arrangements on such a vast scale. They're gagged. They can't talk about it. They're in direct partnership, you know, like the telcos, like Verizon, for example. As we saw from the Snowden, as I knew shortly after 9/11, where the FBI had simply gone to Verizon and said, hey, just turn everything over. Hey, but there's no court order. Just do it and give it to NSA. NSA had access then, back in 2001 in the fall, to all the phone records, all the subscribers of phone records and phone numbers of Verizon. And that's just Verizon. You don't even talk about AT&T or any of the other telcos or any of the other data brokers or the ISPs. So he's central. He is central to understanding how far off the rails we went. And I said then, I've said it publicly, I'll say it again, I no longer recognized the vehicle we were in. I knew that we weren't just off the rails. We were an entirely different vehicle. And it was an anathema form of government, and I had to resist it. because it violated everything I had taken oath to support and defend four times in my government career. But you cannot understand what happened without understanding the central role that General Hayden played in this. And what's worse, the pathology of this. I mean, he himself, when the obvious questions as to why the intelligence apparatus was unable to keep America out of harm's way, why were we unable to defend the nation, why we were unable to prevent just a small handful of hijackers from murdering 3,000 people on 9/11, well, he in executive session gets to say how wonderful it is. He used to chortle about this, hiding behind the shadows, hiding behind the FBI and the CIA, and let them take all the blame for 9/11, while we get to like scoot off into the corner and no one really gets to question us. They absolutely obstructed multiple investigations, including two 9/11. Investigations by Congress. I know because I was prima facie witness to that. At one point, I was actually pulled aside by the then Signals Intelligence Director, who I reported to in my first job at NSA, and was told in no uncertain terms, without actually saying the words, of course, they're looking for leakers. They weren't looking for leakers to the press. They were looking for leakers to Congress and official government investigations, and it was clear the message was, do not tell them anything, or you will pay a very heavy price.
Bill Binney, your comment on Michael Hayden as he parrots the president's handpicked commission that there have been no abuses?
Well, I mean, there's been any number of people arrested using this material that they've collected through the law enforcement agencies alone, not counting the people they have been intimidating. People have been fired from NSA. And also the four of us, Ed Loomis, Kirk Wiebe, Tom, and myself, who've been persecuted over time by them. They attempted to indict us three separate times with false evidence. And in Tom's case, they falsified evidence there, too. So here they were, the Department of Justice, falsifying evidence, trying to convict people to put them in jail for decades under the Espionage Act, using that. To say that there isn't anybody that hasn't been harmed. I mean, my God, we've been struggling for years under this cloud, so to speak. I mean, we couldn't get jobs because we were being investigated by the FBI for crimes. They blackballed us in the intelligence community and any around any agency governments. I mean, sure, to say that nobody's been harmed is just an outright lie.
One of the other things that is so obvious, and yet, it's like the emperor has no clothes. It's very clear that James Clapper lied under oath to a direct question from Senator Wyden. He could have just declined to answer it in public session, but he did answer the question falsely. And we have a defender of his trying to spin it up that he didn't really lie, and the president ultimately has not fired James Clapper. Keith Alexander apparently offered his resignation shortly after Snowden popped up, and Alexander's going to be permitted to keep his job until he retires in a few months. And that lack of a fundamental standard that a high-ranking government official commits perjury before the Congress and gets away with it, to me, that is a true outrage. And you address that in your letter to the president, Bill.
Yes, well, the whole point is that everything they do is fundamentally based on lies. NSA lies to Congress. NSA lies to the administration. The administration lies to Congress. Congress lies to itself. Everybody's lying to one, and they're all built on a foundation of lies.
And don't forget the FISA court.
Yes, the FISA court, too. I mean, that's all there, too. I mean, they keep claiming they've got oversight. The oversight has been a joke for decades. I mean, there is nothing there. Even the Reggie Walton, the chief justice on the FISA court, said, about a month or so, several months ago, that he had limited capacity to even challenge what NSA was telling him. Well, it's also true of the FBI. I mean, and this goes back for decades. I mean, as early as 2002, in the New York Times broke a story about the FISA court discovering that they had been misled by on 75 warrants by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same problem. It's a long-standing problem. This secret court and this and the intelligence committees, they really have no way of verifying what NSA or the FBI or anybody else is telling them. That's why we put into that suggestions that we sent in, that strong one, saying we have to have a technical group that was attached directly to the entire Congress, responsible to them directly, so that they could go into these databases and verify what NSA is saying and what they have as a database and what they're working with.
So it's like a chaperone?
Well, it's more than that. You need to be in their knickers and know exactly everything they're doing, because you can't, if you cannot trust them. I mean, they've got a track record of lying. I mean, even when I was in there in the late 90s, I had to make an announcement at one of the meetings when I was in before a congressional meeting, a committee coming out to get briefed on it. I said, I would not lie to anybody for anybody. And that was in the midst of this group of people who were preparing for this meeting, you know. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of the underlying culture and how it operates.
We're talking with Bill Binney and Tom Drake, former employees, high-ranking officials, actually, at the National Security Agency. And I'll just note, as I mentioned earlier in previous podcasts, Bill Binney, in our conversation that included Tim Shorrock, the journalist from The Nation, last April, detailed the internal struggle over Thin Thread and Trailblazer. And in that exchange, we talked about the very influential contractor called SAIC. It stands for Science Applications International Corporation. They were the lead contractor on Trailblazer, which, as we noted, was a boondoggle that cost billions of dollars and was never actually deployed. And I just wanted to note that recently we learned that they've set up this monitoring center in Oakland, California, that pulls in every video camera, public or private, gunshot cameras, all kinds of information into a central location. And the lead contractor there is SAIC. They've been on the job for about 9 months, and there are already several disputes regarding overbilling and questionable practices regarding the funding there. Now, I want to turn, Tom Drake, to one of the critical elements of this open memo to President Obama, because one of the talking points that is approved by the NSA and is echoed by most of its defenders, most notably Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, is that 9/11 could have been prevented if we'd only had these massive surveillance programs, most notably the telephone record metadata program, in place. And I'd like you to take as long as you need here to explain to our listeners why that is flatly false.
Well, this is part of the dark side history, and it's a burden that I continue to live with, and I still wake up in the middle of the night with cold sweats when I reflect back on what could have been. The system, the intelligence agencies themselves, it's important to note, are not monolithic. There's a lot of rivalry. There's a lot of bickering, even within agencies, because of corruption, institutional politics, organizational dynamics. You cannot understand why could this possibly happen. But it's the height of hypocrisy to suggest that if the mass surveillance program had been put in place, that it could have prevented 9/11, when the truth of history is that the very best of American ingenuity innovation had the solutions in place, had proven those solutions. And there is no doubt in my mind, based on what was actually known, and then to my horror later, discovering what, again, from inside NSA, the actual actionable intelligence, as well as critical intelligence that had never even been discovered, that was hidden in NSA data banks that they didn't even know they had, let alone the stuff they had and didn't share. So it really begs some fundamental questions to use the what if scenario that if we had mass surveillance in place, that we could have prevented it. I just cite more current examples. So if that was the case, we have an more of a mass surveillance system in place now than we ever had, and it didn't stop the Boston Marathon bombers or any of a number of others, and it certainly didn't stop or prevent or halt, or as we've now discovered, the 54 terrorist incidents that they've actually had rolled out shortly after the Snowden disclosures as proof that this works. And it turns out that the one that they cite, it's questionable about whether or not it had any direct influence in the traditional law enforcement. And at no time, even on the one, and that has to do with the several thousands of dollars, it was basically wired money to Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the terrorist group.
By a handful of guys in San Diego.
Yeah, a handful of guys in San Diego, and there was at no time was there any threat to the national security of the United States. They're wiring, you know, material support money to their own, in their own organization. So from the United States,
and even to this day, as we have put advisors into Africa, and we are working to confront Al-Shabaab, I see no indication that Al-Shabaab represents any significant threat to the domestic United States or to any significant U.S. interest.
No, it never has. I mean, this is why you go back to 9/11, which was a fundamental failure, and yet the failure was the excuse, and that's why I accept what you said early on in your opening remarks. The failure was the excuse that we needed mass surveillance and mass tracking, and we needed to pretty much render all laws that protect us from the predations of government, render those all a null and void, just in case the 1%, or I call it the 0.0001%, and that's being kind, somehow it might stop something, and it'd be worth it if we only stop one. So this whole notion, when the very best of American ingenuity innovation, I believe that's one fundamental reason why the government, in extraordinary retaliation, turned the Department of Justice on us, sicked them on us, and the FBI agents, and came after us with everything they had. I mean, they leveled guns at Bill Binney. They were armed, and they came to the door when they raided my house four months later in 2007. They did not appreciate that we were holding up a mirror, and the fact remains they wanted to take off the street and send the most chilling of messages about what actually was known, what could have been. See, the very best of American innovation, necessity being the mother of invention, had solved this problem. You would think, right, and this is to me the absolute travesty of this, that you would want to put the very best you had in the fight, but they didn't want to solve that problem. That problem, by choice that Hayden made shortly after he became the director of NSA, with great fanfare, he launched this multi-billion-dollar program called Trailblazer, and that was going to be the answer to all the questions about would NSA remain relevant in the 21st century. But he made a conscious choice to turn his back on the best of American invention and ingenuity, and simply say, you know what? I'm going to go to that military-industrial complex, and I'm going to spend my billions, and we're going to have an industrial strength solution. Well, that's what we didn't get anything for that. Meanwhile, 9/11 now happens, and we pour the billions and billions, basically open checks, the equivalent open checks are being written by Congress. Hey, NSA, how much money do you need? And how big a check can we write? And I still remember, it's just one of these moments in terms of the culture, Peter. I just want to share with your listening audience, mm-hmm. because it's a way to capture in a much more visible manner what was really happening here. 9/11 was viewed by the vast majority of NSA leadership and management, not by the rank and file, not by the people on the edges of it, because they realized we had failed the nation, fundamentally failed. But it was viewed at the higher levels, wow, this 9/11 is a gift to NSA. It's a direct quote, we're going to get all the money we want and then some. What, we're going to just cash it all in? That national security now becomes something we broker as a way to redistribute massive amounts of wealth to the 1%, to use the Occupy Wall Street phrase? Mm-hmm. That's precisely what happened. And I remember in October of 2002, they had this huge 50th anniversary gala inside the main cafeteria at NSA. It was to celebrate NSA created under the Truman administration, the deepest of secrecy in 1952. And it was, you know, it was the nines. Everybody's dressed up, all the fancy flowers. You know, even for government, we're paying like, you know, $75 a head just to be there. And I remember I was sitting at a table in the back, and they had the head table, and Tim Samples, who at the time was one of the House Intelligence Committee managers, is up on, he's up on the stage, that little stage, of right in front of the head table. And he's got one of those big Publisher Weekly style checks, those fake checks.
Sure, yeah.
And he's handing it over to General Hayden.
Wow.
And there's this gigantic number on it, okay? We're talking not just nine, you know, there's nine zeros, and then there's another couple of digits, okay, in terms of amount next to it.
It was over $10 billion.
It wasn't quite that big yet. It became bigger later.
Right.
We're talking about essentially a doubling of NSA's budget as it existed then. Hayden, and I couldn't hear his words, but the way his face was angled, it was clear what he was saying. He pointed to the check, then he pointed down to George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence and the director of CIA, then back to the check, and you see him mouthing the words, "George, I got my money. George, I got my money. I got my money."
Wow.
The number of people, I mean, I give people their fair due in terms, you know, of, I prefer the free, because capitalism really is a corruption, the free enterprise system. I give people their due. But my gosh, the number of millionaires that were made, and I had people coming to me, Peter, saying, "Tom, do you realize how much money you can make with all your contacts and all your technical background and skills and everything else? Just cash in, everybody else is." So the joke was, all so many people were basically bellying up to the Trailblazer Bar, and there was so much money to go around that everybody's boat was floated higher. That was the environment, this idea that we were going to actually look at the very best that America had. And I'm remembering what happened. This is a year plus later. I'm remembering what I was tasked to do shortly after 9/11. I was given charge at NSA to go out to the ends of NSA, no matter where it took me, to find the very best that we could put into the fight and make it operational, put it out there, even if it wasn't complete, make it happen. Obviously, one of those programs was SynThread, but there was a whole host of other technologies that has never been publicized fully, in fact, in some cases, not even known, that would have gone an extraordinary way to roll the threat up, the threat that we faced before it fully metastasized over the last 12 years, in terms of just that alone, although it was completely overblown even then as to what was the real threat we faced. The real threat was clearly what the government ended up doing, was just tossing aside rights and our freedoms and our liberties as the excuse just in case we found some piece of evidence to stop some anticipated terrorist attack, whether it was here or overseas.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to compromise everything, and it didn't matter. Hey, it's all secret. We don't need to tell the public. We certainly can lie to Congress. I remember sitting in meetings where, you know what, we're not going to tell Congress what they need to hear. We're simply going to tell them what we want them to hear. Well, what kind of environment is that? You're lying to your own overseers on purpose. And meanwhile, guess what you get to do? You get them to send you billions and billions of dollars. Now, you tell me, what is that going to create? There's no incentive to solve the problem that had already been solved. I remember sitting in a meeting, Peter. It was an extraordinary meeting. It was a meeting reviewing the budget. Okay, this is going into after 9/11. We're now sitting in this meeting, the top tier of the Signals Intelligence Directorate, financial folks, contract folks. I'm sitting next to my then boss, the Signals Intelligence Director, Maureen Baginski. And she leans over to me, and we're going on about all the, you know, money that Trailblazer needs, and she says, "Well, Tom," and I'm talking about, you know, "we already have these solutions. You don't need to spend all this money, and in fact, this money could go a long ways toward doing all kinds of other things as well. Why put all the eggs in one basket?" It's just, well, who do I, you know, piss off? Do I piss off, you know, a multi-billion-dollar program, or a program that was developed for just a few million? Well, that was this SIGINT Automation Research Center. And in fact, the joke was, you weren't big enough to get noticed. You need to be at least $10 million.
Hmm.
Well, here he had a multi-billion-dollar program that was just sucking. It was a giant sucking sound. Everything it was going its way, and you weren't supposed to disturb the order. You would not get in the way of the corporate decision. It didn't matter that we already had the answer. It didn't matter we already had the solution.
So it appears the top priority was profiteering for the contractors with the hope that when individuals left NSA, they'd get a cushy six- or seven-figure job with a contractor.
Well, I'll give you one more example, because this, I remember I ended up in another job. I was actually pushed out of the – it was clear. In fact, Marine said, you probably should go back to where you left because we just don't really want you around here. And I just – I took that as another – I'm going to stick around just to spite you in part, but to stick around and continue to fight from within. I was the NSA's corporate advisory board member to the International Council on System Engineering, and they were having – a special conference at Stevens Institute of Technology. And while I was there, they had an evening event hosted by the president of the university, spectacular views of the southern end of Manhattan as you look out across from Hoboken and the high cliffs in New Jersey. I'm in the tart room, the dessert room. I get to talking to a former, well, he was then, but now former member of the Defense Science Board, highest advisory board to the Secretary of Defense for the Department of Defense. And he says, Tom, he's chit-chatting with me about where I was. He says, yeah, stay in 5 years tops. The real money is when you get out. And believe me, that's where the real money is. Now, it's important to note, when was this? This was in the 2004 time frame. 2004. We're not even 3 years removed from 9/11. And this is a senior member of the Defense Science Board. And all he's talking about is how much money he's making because of 9/11. It became an extraordinary growth industry across the board in this space. Phenomenal amounts of money being poured into the military-industrial complex and what now I started calling the intelligence, cybersecurity complex.
Mm-hmm.
Staggering amounts. Who cares about a solution while we get belly up to the trough of all this money?
And let's just put it back in context here. That this profiteering and this atmosphere of anything goes, we can spend as much as we need to, was all based on maintaining the lie that you didn't have the tools on 9/11 to uncover the hijacker plots, when in fact you were sitting on information, at least about the guys in San Diego, and did not share that with any other critical federal agency.
Peter, you just hit on something that was shared, as you know, directly from the memo. It's one of the key pieces of prima facie evidence that I still shudder. I'm doing it right now when I think about what could have been. Because I was tasked, this was a few months later, Saxby Chambliss, who then headed up the subcommittee for one of the House Intel committees, it actually was a rather new committee on Homeland Security, of all things. He started asking, and it was like the preliminary investigation to the Joint Inquiry, which was much, much larger, that kicked off later in 2002. He announced in December 2001, I became a whistleblower material witness for that committee. And they're asking all the right questions. During a leadership meeting, I was directly charged with leading the effort at NSA as a senior executive. The statement for the record, where NSA would actually come down in closed session before Saxby Chambliss' subcommittee on the Hill and basically open up the kimono. We would just say what we knew, didn't know, what we could have done, what we didn't do, and just say it. And I spent, we were under extreme time constraints. And I remember it was about two weeks or so, where I'm going around to everybody I knew and then some, out to the leading edges of NSA, going all to the analysts, the intelligence producers, the people in the field. I left no stone unturned to use to turn that phrase, to find what we knew, could have known, did know, didn't share, might have shared, or anything that was undiscovered. And one of the things that I discovered was that NSA actually knew. They knew, had those numbers on covers, we would say, had them for a number of years, and
simply didn't share the information with others who needed to know for actionable intelligence. I mean, it's just, and that was just one, but it was critical intelligence. Of course, there was failures on the part of the CIA and the FBI, but here's absolutely prima facie evidence that NSA knew and did not share. And it gets into culture, it gets into a whole lot of things. But the fact remains, this is crucial. I mean, this was the centerpiece planning cell, okay, of the 9/11 plot by the hijackers. And here was NSA, had the numbers, had the information, had the content. Now, what happened? I'm overseas at a partner location, right? I get a frantic phone call from one of my direct reports saying, Tom, we've been taking off the effort, to put together the statement for the record. And I was in direct partnership, all approved, with the Legislative Affairs Office, working with all the key senior executives and senior managers across NSA. You've been taking off the effort. And I said, why? I don't know. You're going to have to find out from Maureen Baginski when you get back. The first thing I did when I came back in the United States from overseas is I went right into her office, okay, and I confronted her, and she would not talk to me about it. In the leadership meeting, I once again brought it up. Why was I removed off of the statement for the record effort? I was the lead for it, and she said, I'm going to have to tell you later. And she would not say what it was. So when I confront, other than she said it was a data integrity problem, euphemism, we were not going to tell an official investigation what we actually knew but had not shared with the rest of the community, let alone the national command authorities, who could have taken the necessary action.
Well, Tom, if I can interject, it sounds to me like you are offering accurate data with a little too much integrity.
Apparently so, and Bill can speak very directly to what it means when you offer accurate, fact-based information in defense of the nation. One of the two primary responsibilities of the government, the preamble, provide for the common defense. And yet, too much integrity? The data integrity? Yeah, my own integrity, I guess, was too high for them to swallow. We're going to continue to obstruct the investigation. We're going to lie to Congress. And as it turned out, they buried the truth of what they actually knew. Now, of course, I shared all this with that investigation as well as the subsequent investigation it was the 9/11 Joint Inquiry, combining both the House Intel and the Senate Intel Committees over a number of months. So you know that you understand why they would come after us, right? Plus, we were part of that Department of Defense Office Inspector General audit of Trailblazer and Thin Thread. Mm-hmm. The requirements for it, okay? So, yeah, it was an integrity problem. That's right.
Let me turn to Bill here for a comment and load up just a follow-up question, and that is, how much of what Tom Drake just told us do you think President Obama actually knows?
I'm not sure he knows too much of it. I mean, he should recognize the underlying corruption theme there. But I did want to add one thing about that Al-Shabaab issue.
Sure.
That they were saying this is one case where they contributed in this.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that the transfer of money to Al-Shabaab in Africa, one end of that transfer had to be foreign. The same would be true if they had a phone call or an email to them. One end would be foreign. So the point is getting back to collecting U.S. to U.S. communications or U.S. to U.S. transfer of finances or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the constitutional violation. It has nothing to do with terrorism, and it's not even relevant. And no case has it ever been used in that. So that makes it zero cases have U.S. to U.S. Violations of constitutional rights of people been used to uncover terrorist threats.
Oh, you spooks are just too literal, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, well, I just wanted to point out the basic fact there, you know?
But now they're calling it. See, now that that truth is confronting them in the public arena now, they're saying, oh, it's just an insurance policy.
Mm-hmm.
The mass policy.
Yeah.
Really?
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. Clapper,
insurance
Clapper
policy? What's the payoff?
I can sleep and better.
Apparently, it's a very high
better.
Deductible.
That's right.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, well, it's all a sham anyway. The point is they're doing it for law enforcement because it makes their job easy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also using it. I mean, we're becoming a police state because of this. And this is being spread around the world. This is the basic issue here.
Well, I've been talking about the creeping police state for several years now, Bill, and it's nice to have that affirmed by someone who knows so much more than I do.
And it's behind the scenes this has been going on, so it's all done in secret, too. Remember, this is the perjury policy in action.
Yeah.
Bill, now remember, Peter,
go ahead,
you know, I'm just going to, you know, Obama actually said it best. He actually did. And you'll recognize, and I'm paraphrasing, remember back a few years ago he said no more illegal wiretapping of American citizens? He said no more national security letters to spy on citizens not suspected of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
Remember he said something about no more tracking of citizens who did nothing more than protest and no more ignoring law when it's inconvenient. Remember that was in a 2007 speech.
Right.
And then he goes on to say this administration, referring to Bush, acts like violent, and I'm just as a direct quote, because there's one I remember so clearly now. You know, now we're talking seven years later. This administration acts like, quote, violating civil liberties is the way to enhance our security, unquote.
Well, he said it very well. I wish he still believed it. Bill, I want to get your comment, because shortly before we sat down to talk here today, I got an email from a group in Washington. It's the Center for Security Policy, run by Frank Gaffney. And they published an article in a publication I've never heard of called the Washington Free Beacon. And I guess this is several ranks below the Mooney Washington Times. At any rate, it's like a propaganda press release. And it says that altering NSA surveillance programs would interfere with vital intelligence operations. And I won't pain you with any further quotes from it, but it has just these predictable statements that sound like Dick Cheney and Michael Hayden recent talking points. And the question I have for you, do you think that, kind of like Brer Rabbit, that they keep talking about the metadata program? Please don't take away my, don't, no, no, you can't take, Dianne Feinstein wants to legalize the metadata. Don't take it away. Don't take it away. Is this the cutout that they're willing to sacrifice to maintain all the programs that haven't gotten much attention or that may still be completely secret?
Well, the ones that are still completely secret involve all the content of these communications that they're collecting, too. Most of it's email, but a good deal of it's phone.
Mm-hmm.
And the metadata, by the way, the program, they're talking about one program. That's what Feinstein says.
Mm-hmm.
Some people refer to her as Dialy, but, you know, the point is that it's not one program. It's one process, and the process will run on whatever data you feed it. If you feed it foreign to foreign information, it will work on that. If you read it foreign to U.S., it'll work on that. If you feed it U.S. to U.S., it'll work on that. If you say, you, NSA, can no longer collect U.S. to U.S. data, stop it immediately, then that has no effect on the program that's running. It will still continue to run on the process, on the whatever data it's fed that is a foreign end, or both ends are foreign.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you want to do foreign intelligence, the program will still do that.
Yeah.
If you want to do domestic intelligence, then you have to feed in domestic data,
mm-hmm.
which is why they created the program Stellar Wind, to feed in domestic data.
Which is what I was confronted with independently and then later corroborated with Bill and company, as well as yet others, and more of it became known even after they left during the time that I remained. I was told in no uncertain terms that you don't understand, Mr. Drake. We just need the data. The whole focus became just get the data. So if there was anything out there that they didn't have, they became absolutely obsessed with collecting it. And it didn't matter what the source was. It didn't matter what the restrictions were. It simply didn't matter. And in fact, what was a relatively small office, which is, I knew it as commercial technologies, they expanded by leaps and bounds existing secret arrangements with certain companies to simply pull, in the deepest of secrecy, as much data as they could through various means back to NSA or have direct access to it. And you see under the Snowden disclosures starting in June how far that has gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now this,
it's not all been exposed yet.
But then, if you as I said, if the goal simply becomes we need to keep creating a bigger haystack, then that means that you'll never ultimately you're going to be further and further challenged with finding any needles. Why? Because every straw of that haystack becomes a potential needle. You'll have great difficulty distinguishing a straw from needle.
So, Bill Binney, as we wrap up this first installment, and we'll do a second installment about your recommendations for real reform to the surveillance community in this country, I asked you earlier, and you told me that a White House counsel has received your memo. Outside the White House, what kind of response are you getting? Are some of the senators, like Wyden from Oregon, who's been one of the sharp critics of the abuses, responding to your memo, for example?
Actually, we're not. I have no direct evidence that anybody's responding yet.
Okay.
I think they're all pretty much still waiting for the president to come out and announce what he's going to do. So otherwise, all these discussions are taking place, as is typical with this administration, in secret.
Mm-hmm. And Tom Drake, have you gotten any feedback from official or non-official sources?
Well, I'm well aware our memo and the 21 set of recommendations was, in fact, given directly, given to the White House counsel. I mean, that's significant in the fact that at least hard copies were provided to someone pretty high up within the White House. I'm also aware at the staff level, the same set, the memos and recommendations, as well as other documentation being given, delivered to staffers of key senators as well as representatives.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to say here to you, Peter, and your listening audience, there has been no phone call, no formal request, no invitation from any senator or representative. With all of these disclosures, the Snowden disclosure in particular, put all this back on the front burner, and people revisiting our own cases, what happened to me, what happened to Bill, and our other colleagues, Diane Rourke, and yet others, some that you don't even know about publicly, mm-hmm. during this whole period, no invitation. I'm still waiting. I'm still 12 years plus later. I am still waiting for the phone call. We've had back channel comms. I did even during this whole last several days with respect to the memo and the recommendations with key staffers who actually work with Wyden. But the senators themselves, including Senator Wyden, efforts. There's been grassroots efforts to have them even on one-on-one meetings, or have them even at least make the effort to bring us before a committee. None. It's been radio silence.
That's Thomas Drake, former NSA high-ranking official, and William Binney joined us as well today. I thank you both for this important memo to the president. We'll link to it in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Be sure to follow up and download the Part 2 podcast with NSA whistleblowers Tom Drake and Bill Binney, coming at you very soon.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.